This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. This is an extended version of the original Radio 4 broadcast, and for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is John Cooper Clarke. Nicknamed the Bard of Salford, he first started writing poems at the age of 12. By 14, it was all he wanted to do. In the early 1970s, his dream came true, though the reality of being a professional poet wasn't exactly Wordsworth's emotion recollected in tranquility. Bernard Manning gave him his first paid club gig, and he went on to earn his stripes by surviving showers of phlegm and bottles to share stages with the likes of the Sex Pistols, Buzzcocks and Susie and the Banshees. He has been Punk's Poet Laureate ever since. He says poetry, out of any art, is the only one that everyone has a go at. You don't need a load of expensive equipment or a musical instrument or tap dancing lessons. All you need is imagination and a pen. John Cooper Clarke, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Hello, Lauren. Thank you for having me.
So if anyone can do it, what makes a good poem?
A good poem? It's the kiss of death, isn't it, to overanalyse what you do. A good poem. For instance, here's one of the ones that got me interested. I'm going to quote a line from a number called Woodman Spare That Tree by a guy who I found very inspiring as a lad, Phil Harris. And it was, Woodman, spare that tree, chop not a single bough. 10 years it has protected me, and I'll protect it now. Go chop a birch, a elm or a pine, but leave old Slippery there, that's mine. That's the only tree my wife can't climb, Mr. Woodman. Spare it for me. So things like that, that's poetry. And
what inspires you to
unlikely write? Subjects is a good one. You know, talking something up. The kind of things that people ignore, you know, when you talk them up in a poem. Suddenly, you know, you can like underline the importance of just everyday, you know, things.
Finding the universal in the particular.
Yeah, you got it. Finding the universal in the particular.
You've said that you write in response to public anxiety, but your poems aren't political. Why not?
Well, I think the poetry and the politics suffer for it. You know, anybody that can be converted to a particular worldview because of a poem. Yeah, I think they're looking in the wrong places for whatever it is they want. But to hitch your poetry to any particular political wagon is always a mistake. Because poetry is forever. You know, you write a poem and it's out there and it's you can't unwrite it. And politically, you know, well, one can change one's mind many times a day.
Now, I understand that you've been compiling your Desert Island Discs music list for quite a few years now. Are you happy with today's selections?
I'll probably change my mind. I've revised this list for, you know, 60 years. I've been a fan of the show for that long. I'm not even joking.
Well, I'm glad you put the hours in because it's a really sensational list. Let's get stuck into your first.
A lot.
Tell me about this one, disc number one. Why did you choose it?
Ah, yes. By the way, if I might explain how important I feel this show to be, I see it as, like I say, you know, poetry is forever. So is Desert Island Discs. You know, not many people get a second bite of the apple. It has happened, I believe.
That's right, yes. Okay.
But it's too late for me to do that. So it's my one chance. So for me, you know, Desert Island Discs has all the finality of a suicide note without the actual obligation of topping yourself. As you can see, I'm a coconut half empty kind of guy. This island.
The music's not like that. Luckily, it's an uplifting selection of tracks.
I hope so. Well, with that in mind, the first choice, which is A Quiet Place by Garnet Mims. Really, what I've got on this desert island, terrifying though the prospects of this abject loneliness is for me, what I've got here is everything that Garnet Mims wants in this here poem. So it's a kind of reminder that it's not all beer and skittles living in the inner city.
There's a man next door with a radio, and he plays it all through the night. There's a couple in the apartment above my head that don't do nothing but fuss and fight. I can't get no sleep in this noisy street. I've got to move,
I've got to move, I've got to find me a quiet place.
Garnet Mims and A Quiet Place. We want to take you back to another unquiet place, John Cooper Clarke, growing up in your neighbourhood in Salford back in the 50s. I think you once said that the best piece of advice you ever received was from your dad, George. Can you remember what it was?
Well, there were two pieces of advice that I've never forgotten. One was never work for nothing, even if it's a flaky job like I've got. And never leave a bookies with a smile on your face.
That was the one I heard.
Is that the one?
So, yes, he was. Tell me a little bit more about him. What was your dad like?
My dad was an engineer wiring up power stations. You know, he took electricity as far away as Inverness. Yeah, he was a funny guy and real good geezer.
And what about your mum, Hilda?
My mum was a living saint.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, hyper-literate, didn't go out much. I get my love of reading from her, no question. We'd be reading five books at a time from the public library, those great public libraries.
And she was a film fan as well?
Yeah, well, you know, being as how my dad used to work away all the time, she was kind of at a loss. And I guess I was her movie date. We had an arrangement whereby for every two cowboy or gangster movies, I'd have to go to see three, what they call women's pictures. I mean, movies like, for instance, The Best of Everything, starring Hope Lang, Peyton Place. We'd go to see movies like that, and I could always find something to enjoy in them, though. You know, they were like American movies, so I'd look at what the guys were wearing, you know, tab-collared shirts and shark-skin Ivy League suits, things like that that just didn't appear in any gents outfitters outside of Cheetah Mill.
And what was Salford like in the 50s?
Well, where we lived, because we always lived in apartments, and our apartment gave out onto what was, without a doubt, the busiest crossroads in the north of England. Pre-motorway, so it was all like commercial traffic, you know, real chocker. I loved it, you know, I didn't know any different. We had eight movie theatres within walking distance. And when I say walking distance, I hate walking. They were close.
You got TB when you were 7 or 8 and you were sent away to convalesce with relatives in Rhyl. How did that go?
Well, I thought it was great because obviously I couldn't stay in the part of Salford where I was living, so it wasn't very far away from Trafford Park. Trafford Park then was probably the biggest industrial complex outside of the Soviet Union. So I had to get moved out, and the nearest place to move me out to, well, the most convenient, because, you know, we weren't made of money. We had a relative in Rhyl, North Wales, which then was a flourishing holiday resort, you know, the equal of Blackpool. And I was more or less, you know, feral. I was kind of turfed out of the house at 10 a.m. and wasn't expected back till tea time. So I used to sort of knock around the fairground and, you know, I made myself useful.
What was the lure of that then? Was it the sound systems?
Yeah, yeah, well, that's right. They would be playing, you know, music while you work would be rock and roll. Gene Vincent, Elvis, you know, all the good stuff. The Everly Brothers, Harmonies from Heaven.
It's time to hear your next disc. Did you hear this one at the fairground? This is
yes, I did. Yeah, selection. What a mover. Jerry Lee Lewis, the greatest piano player that ever lived. Whole lot of shaking going on.
Come on over, baby. Whole lot of shaking going on. Yes, I say, come on over, baby. Baby, you can't go wrong. We ain't faking. Whole lot of shaking going on. Well, I say, come on over, baby. We got chicken in the corner.
Shaking on, yeah, let's shake, let's shake.
Jerry Lee Lewis and a whole lot of shaking going on. John Cooper Clarke, we've heard a little bit about life at home. How did you get on at school? You missed a little bit because of your tuberculosis.
Yeah, I could have been a genius. I did miss out on a lot of school, but I don't feel like I missed anything. I hated school, you know, and anything that took me out of there was okay by me. But I'm glad I learnt to read. And I'm glad they rammed those facts down my reluctant throat when they did. But I hated it.
Why?
I don't know. I've never been really a team player. That must have been on every school report I ever had was no team spirit. Yeah, you wouldn't get me in a gang.
You did have one teacher who inspired you, though. Your English teacher,
I did, yes,
John Malone.
John Malone. He was a rugged outdoor type. He would return from the summer holidays every September with some kind of injury that he'd incurred, indulging in some outdoor pursuit or other, mountaineering, water skiing, abseiling. But he did have this weakness for the romantic poetry of the 19th century, which he conveyed to the entire class. You know, and we weren't like, it wasn't the kind of school where you'd expect them to be over receptive to poetry. You know, it was quite a tough school. Put it this way, we had our own coroner. But seriously, he imparted his love of romantic 19th century verse to the entire class till it became a hothouse of poetic competition, to the point where it was a badge of honour to use polysyllabic speech at all times. It was amazing how it caught on. But I was the best at it, so that's where I flourished.
So you said the romantic poets of the 19th century, like who connected with you first?
Well,
what did you love?
The one that struck me was Edgar Allan Poe. We had to learn them off by heart, Michael Gove style. Really, it's the only way to do it. The way poetry works is it sneaks up on you 30 years later. You're not going to understand it. It was written by a 40-year-old guy. You're 12. Just learn the words and then, you know, 30 years later, you know, wow, it's amazing how it makes its mark. I can't think of a better way of being introduced to poetry. And then I found, upon reading up on Edgar Allan Poe, I found out that his entire body of work had been translated into French by Charles Baudelaire. So that was a name I remembered, and I resolved to read his poetry in translation. And ever since then, Charles Baudelaire has been, without a doubt, my number one guy, poetry-wise.
What were you writing? What were your early poems like?
I got a commission to write a poem about the Ideal Homes exhibition. I wish I still had it. It was an annual event at the City Hall in Manchester. Was, you know, all the latest mod cons, you know, the Prestige Minute Mop, Morphy Richards steam irons, and all these things had a yearly update. So I was sent to sort of report back poetically.
And how did it go?
Oh, it was top notch. I wish I could, I can't remember any of it at all, but it was a great piece of work.
A hymn to labour-saving devices.
Yeah, we didn't have any of those things. My parents had an aversion to higher purchase. You know, I was always on at them, you know. Get a Hoover, will you? Like most working-class people in the 50s, they were terrified of debt. So the Ideal Homes exhibition, to me, was a wonderland of treasures.
It's time for some more music, John. Tell us about your third disc. Why did you select this one?
Oh, Dion and the Belts. I love doo-wop music. I went to see Dion about 1961, and he was the best dressed, the most handsome man I'd ever seen. But this is Dion and the Belmonts. The Belmonts being Dion, being Dion Francis Di Mucci, Carlo Mastrangelo, Fred Milano, and Angelo Diallo.
No, I love you like I do. No, I do. Don't know why I love you. Don't know why I care. I just want your love to share. I wonder why I love you like I do. Is it because I think you love me too? I wonder why I love you like I do. Like I do.
Dion Brown and the Belmonts, I Wonder Why. John Cooper Clarke, after school, you took early jobs as a printing compositor, a lab technician at Salford Tech, and as a fire watcher on Plymouth Docks. You continued writing during all of this and were convinced that poetry as entertainment would work. Why were you so certain?
I was convinced that if the poetry was entertaining enough, well, why doesn't it belong in the entertainment business? And you can take this back to the days of the Edwardian musical, you know, not even funny stuff, you know, sentimental nature boy stuff would really fly in the music halls of Whitechapel and beyond, you know.
But what about Salford in the 50s? I mean...
Well, again, you know, there was always evidence of it. You know, the ghost of poetry is there with Stanley Holloway. Stanley Holloway and the aforementioned Phil Harris. You'd get these singers that didn't actually sing. Rex Harrison. You know, there's a guy that spoke every song he was ever given. Why got a woman? Be more like a man. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I read that you did used to watch Opportunity Knocks.
Yeah, that's there again. That was validation. You know, when I used to say, you know, I want to be a professional poet for a living, you know, because that's what I took from reading about Baudelaire, you know, reading about his life. He didn't do anything other than write poetry and schmy around aimlessly, you know, schlepping from one coffee house to another. You know what I mean? And I thought, wow, the life of a useless flaneur can be yours by virtue of poetry. That was the life for me, the life of an idle boulevardier.
And when you would tell people that you wanted to be a poet?
Yeah, well, they would all say, nobody makes a living out of poetry. And I'd mention a few poets that they might have heard of. What about Philip Larkin? He's a librarian. You know, T.S. Eliot, he was a bank clerk. You know, they all had these other jobs. You know, he received a generous stipend from Oxford University, you know. And there was always some reason why they could do it, but I can't. It was the only life that I would settle for, frankly. The only life I could imagine ever making any success at.
And Pam Ayres was popular. She was doing well.
Yeah, well, I'm getting to that. Yeah, well, then, after Opportunity Knocks and she started gathering in the votes, every week for a year, the British public were voting her back. And so I was like, there you are, there you are. Why not me? She writes about her life. I write about mine, you know.
Well, exactly. So your first paid gig came in the early 1970s, courtesy of Bernard Manning at his Embassy Club in Manchester. How did you persuade him to book you?
Well, a judicious choice of poem, right? Obviously, when I said to Bernard, you know, he said, what is it you do? So I said, poetry, Mr. Manning, you know. He said, oh, they don't like poetry. Half of them can't bleeping read.
So what did you say?
So I said, no, it's nothing too high-flown, Mr. Manning. I'll give you a demo. So I'd just written this number, Salome, set in the Ritz in Manchester, which I knew Bernard would have known very well. So I give him the line, I'm going to have to bleep myself here.
Okay.
It's about a punch-up that kicks off, and she gets dragged into it, this woman, Salome Maloney. And the line is... When the punch-up was over, she was lying on the deck. She fell off her stiletto heels and broke her bleeping neck. So as soon as he read that, he said, oh, yeah, oh, that ought to fly. All right, I'll give you a chance.
And you were off.
Yeah. But I was met with the poet's worst enemy, indifference. They weren't there for me. All it takes is for everybody to start talking to each other, and that's you all over. One man, one mic. One mic ain't enough if the entire hall's in conversation with each other.
You did end up getting a residency at a club called Mr. Smith's.
Yeah, Mr. Smith's. I did. Well, after doing Bernard's, I thought, you know, I'm going to take it into the centre of town. But it was pre-punk, see? And I'd kind of modelled myself, my sort of poetic showbiz persona. There's a movie called The Small World of Sammy Lee starring Anthony Newley. And what he does for a living is he's an MC in several strip joints in Soho. It's 1961. It's kind of real proto-mod movie, you know. So he kind of lives in a tuxedo, short-hair Ivy League suit look. You know, I thought that is the uniform of the nightclub entertainer. So when punk happened, I didn't look like a hippie, put it that way, which was a rare thing in those days. Narrow trousers. narrow lapels, shades. Skinny tie. Yeah.
So, I mean, punk shows, pretty bracing back in those days. What was it like performing for that crowd once the scene really took off?
Do you know, once it took off, it was great. You know, it wasn't all dodgy and bottles and phlegm. That didn't last very long. Some of them liked it and some of them didn't. I was playing it for laughs, and there was a guy called Howard Devoto, who was then the singer with the Buzzcocks, who convinced me that I should be playing these punk venues. He said, you know, he pointed out that the concerns that are dealt with in my poems were singing from the same hymn sheet as the punk rock world. For me, poetry is the shortest way of conveying something really big. And I think that's what my poems had in common with the lyrics of John Lydon and Joe Strummer and Mick Jones. Broadly social, abrasive at times, and yet with its own kind of feral attraction. The lyrical style of punk rock I found a great kinship with, specifically the Ramones, who I thought were sensational lyricists. How the hell am I going to tell them I ain't got no cerebellum?
Yeah, that is
That's
poetry,
man.
It's time to go to the music, John. It's your fourth disc. Tell me about this one.
Ella Fitzgerald. Well, I should imagine this would be a nice piece of escapism on that desert island. And one thing that I think you would miss more than anything else would be the voice of a woman. And what a voice in this case. Well, that's what Ella Fitzgerald does. She sings beautiful songs, beautifully.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Won't you tell me where my love can be? Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed? Skylark, have you seen a valley green with spring?
Ella Fitzgerald and Skylark. So, John Cooper Clarke, you were making albums of your poetry around this time as well. You had a top 40 hit with Gimmicks, and your first published collection, 10 Years in an Open-Necked Shirt, was published in 1983. How did you feel about your life at that point?
Well, it was all in the upward trajectory, but it got a bit out of my hands, to be honest. Once it became a kind of ensemble piece with musicians, you know, none of whom I really knew very well. And I mean, they were all excellent musicians as well, not many of them punks. When I hear it now, I hear my poems with music, it sounds to me like I've had one of my feet has been nailed to the floor. You know what I mean? Because, you know, I vary the speed of it even through one poem. You know, some of it's fast, some of it's dragged out. You know what I mean? And only I can know how to do that, you know, and that's the sort of edgy part of it, really. Like I say, you know, when poetry and music go together, it's called a song. And I don't have anything against, I love singing. That's why I drink.
You once said that the taint of punk was the kiss of death once the 1980s arrived. So wasn't there a place for you in the age of the music video?
Oh, yeah, it was all over by 1980. It became conspicuous consumption. So anything that was, like, tarred with the punk brush was surplus to requirements. That's rock and roll for you, you know.
But personally, it must have been tough.
Well, I always worked, you know, I never stopped working, but I was doing smaller joints and I wasn't writing as much as I should have been.
By this time, you'd developed a heroin addiction that lasted 17 years. How bad did it get during that period?
Well, everything was great after that. No, but seriously, obviously, I'm being sarcastic with myself. That is the centre of your universe, and there was always something better to do than write a poem. You're going to get the same. I mean, you know, every drug addict is virtually the same person, you know. There's not really much point in dwelling on it, but I needed money more than ever, so I had to work. The glamour was flaking off with every new job. I really felt like I was sort of selling my sorry ass. at times. There was a tedious saying among hippies, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And that's why I'm no expert in these questions that you're asking me, because I was very much part of the problem, you know. And how did I quit? I did it in two ways, gradually and suddenly.
Were you scared for yourself at any point?
No. No, I don't remember fear being one of the factors now, if I'm honest. I mean, I've been in scary situations around it, but I think when I quit, I felt really badly done to. Like, you know, I didn't want to quit.
Really? So why explain that,
no,
though?
No, I don't think anybody does. I think, you know, it's a long time since I cleaned up.
Yeah, but it's interesting that you say you felt really badly done to, and I'm just wondering, like...
What, quitting?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's just, you feel you're doing it for society or something, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? I thought I was doing everybody a favour. Everybody was worried about me, what can I say? Who wants to be a source of anxiety to everybody they know? You know, you're just trouble.
It's time to go to the music. This is your fifth. Tell me about it.
Yeah, Nico. This brings us to Nico, I guess, yeah. Well, this is a very mysterious tune. Enigmatic wouldn't be too big a word for it. And that is a poetic connection. If something has a mysterious value where the allure never wears off, no matter how many times you hear it, most people would describe that as poetic. And here's a great example of a poetic song sung by a very poetic person, the late Krista Pafkin, Nico, I'll Keep It With Mine.
Some people are very kind, but if I can save you any time, come on.
Nico and I'll Keep It With Mine. John Cooper Clark, you lived with Nico for a while.
Yes, I had an apartment in Brixton, and she'd gone on a short tour of Italy and had neglected to pay her rent. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we shared an apartment. The people she knew was unbelievable, you know, Federico Fellini. I don't know too many people that can drop names like that.
John, I've heard you say that you had to force yourself to work, to write during your recovery. Tell me about that. Why did you have to make yourself sit down and put pen to paper?
When I quit using,
yeah,
it took a long time to get back into it. I'd kind of, you know, I'd got out of the habit of writing poetry. I think it was a good thing. I kind of, the poetry I write now is so markedly different and superior to everything that was around before that. I truly feel this to be the case. And there's something about the writing of poetry that involves a particular kind of magic that I don't care to really look at.
But how did it feel to get that back, to know that you still had the touch, you could still do it?
Well, marvellous, because I really did think that you can lose this. And now I know that you can. No, I don't let anything escape now. And I love the stuff that I write now.
You met your second wife, Evie, in the late 80s. I heard that you bonded over a copy of Les Fleurs du Mal.
Yes, I had recently acquired a new translation of Les Fleurs du Mal by the aforementioned Charles Baudelaire. And I was anxious to find out if this was a good translation. And who better to ask than Ms. Eveline Pluse, who was then a language teacher and whose favourite poet was Charles Baudelaire.
You became a dad to Stella in the early 90s. What was and what is parenthood like?
If I'd have known how much fun it is having a kid, I would have had 17 of them. I was very, very late to it, 45. And, you know, all my life, you know, all my mates have had kids, and they'd be saying, don't ever have kids. That was always their advert, you know what I mean? But I wish I hadn't listened to those miserable people because, you know, if I'd have known how much fun it was, as I say, I would have had 17 of them. Although, you know, my daughter is, as anybody would say, special.
Let's have some more music. This is your sixth disc. Why have you chosen it?
This is Moonlight in Vermont. Again, a nice switch into another landscape altogether. Vermont, New England, ski resort, deciduous trees. What's life without Sinatra? Nothing. Moonlight in Vermont, ski trails on a mountainside. That's the sort of thing you want to be musing over on a sweltering island.
Pennies in a stream, falling leaves, a sycamore, moonlight in Vermont. I see finger wave, ski trails on a mountainside, snow light in Vermont.
Frank Sinatra and Moonlight in Vermont, conjuring up another beautiful musical vista, John Cooper Clarke.
Yes, indeed. Thanks for bringing that up. I think these geographical reveries that I've included here, it seems to me that not all of your guests take the context into account. So I think the safe way to go is geography, landscapes, vistas, as you so beautifully put it.
We appreciate you going to all that effort, John. Your poem, Evidently Chicken Town, was used over the end credits of an episode.
Actually, can I just say, I'm sorry for cutting in here. While we're on the subject of other guests, here's something I've found.
Go on.
Nobody's ever picked the theme music. A Sleepy Lagoon, it's called. It's got lyrics,
they have,
know.
They have.
With or without lyrics?
Without.
You know the lyrics. It's called A Sleepy Lagoon, isn't it? A Sleepy Lagoon, a tropical moon, and you on an island. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
It would be a good choice.
It certainly would.
But somebody's done that. Somebody did that.
Yeah. So listen, John, I've got to ask you about The Sopranos. Your poem, Evidently Chicken Town, was used over the end credits of an episode of The Sopranos in 2007, and that would prove a big turning point for you.
Oh, absolutely. I was coming to the end of the wilderness years. I wasn't consulted. I didn't have any representation of any kind, so how would nobody even knew where I lived? But I'm so glad they took the law into their own hands and used it. My God, that opens doors. Television-wise, it's the three S's. The Simpsons, Seinfeld and The Sopranos. TV's finest 3 hours.
The Sopranos also introduced you to Plan B, who asked you to collaborate on the album Ill Manners. And then, in 2013, an adaptation of another of your poems, I Want to Be Yours...
Yes, indeed.
..was on Arctic Monkeys' album AM. How did that come about with the Arctic Monkeys?
I was doing a show at the Boardwalk in Sheffield, and the proprietor said, would you just have a word with these lads? Big fans of your work. They'd done my stuff at school, you know.
At GCSEs?
Yeah. That was great, having my stuff rammed down the reluctant throats of school children, and there was nothing they could do about it. Yeah. Anyway, I'm on my way out of the Boardwalk. Have a word with these lads. They're in a band. We think they're going to be really big. So I says, what are they called? The Arctic Monkeys. I thought, that's a terrific name. There's no monkeys in the Arctic. You know, immediately you've got a dichotomy. It's going to stick it in your head forever. So, yeah, sure. And there they were, shy schoolboys, very polite, nice kids. But I knew they had something, you know. But it did me, fantastic. I couldn't be happier with their cover of I Want to Be Yours.
Your second collection, The Luckiest Guy Alive, was published in 2018. People call it a comeback. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thing is I've never been away. So I mean, actually, I'm more high profile now than I ever was, is the truth of it, you know. Mm-hmm. I was a kind of elusive, sort of semi-glamorous, shadowy figure in the punk rock years. But now, you know, pretty kind of mainstream, you know. You'd have to have lived in a cave for the last 3 years to not know the name of Dr. John Cooper Clarke. So that's great. I wouldn't have it any other way.
All right, then. Time for your seventh disc. Why have you chosen this one?
Doris Day. And this is the first woman I fell in love with at a very early age. Again, with the geographical travelogue. Picture her in that buggy driving through a blizzard. Finally dressed as a woman, Calamity Jane, with this one, The Black Hills of Dakota. She was the first golden vision of womanhood that registered as 100% adorable. The late, sadly, Doris Day, Black Hills of Dakota.
Take me back to the Black Hills, the Black Hills of Dakota. To the beautiful Indian country that I love. Lost my heart in the Black Hills of Dakota, where the pines are so high that they kiss the sky above.
Doris Day and the Black Hills of Dakota. Joan Cooper Clarke, I wonder what your parents made of your success, the fact that you made it as a poet.
Oh, they did see some of it, yeah, without a doubt, but not at this high-octane level that I'm enjoying today. But, I mean, this one, this would have impressed the hell out of them, you know. My mum, anyway, she was a big radio person. Yeah, I'm sure she would have been as thrilled as I.
You're cited as an influence by artists from several disciplines, poets, comics, musicians. Where do you see your influence today?
I don't know about influence, but I think I've created a platform. You know, it's a legitimate thing to do now, write poetry and read it in public. This Baudelairean idea of having an idle life and yet contributing somehow to the quality of everybody's life is just the best that I could ever have hoped for, really.
And what would you say to a young poet who's listening to this and is looking for advice?
My advice to any poet, you have to be idle to write it. A pen, a notebook, and idleness. Those are the three requisites for the manufacture of poetry.
It's time for your final Desert Island Disc selection. John Cooper Clarke, what's it going to be?
Well, this is the greatest singer that ever lived. If any guy changed the nature of our world, it's this fellow. The zenith of male beauty. And you're on your own at Desert Island. Sooner or later, you're going to have to want to contemplate the nature of eternity. There is only one guy with the vocal equipment to do this, and that's Elvis Presley, with his wonderful reading of How Great Thou Art.
Then sings my soul,
Elvis, and How Great Thou Art. John Cooper Clarke, I'm about to cast you away then to a very solitary existence on your island. How do you think you'll cope?
Well, I'm not the most practical guy in the world, but I don't have a suicidal bone in my body. So I would first of all attempt to construct an antebellum mansion out of palm fronds and shells.
Well, that'll keep you busy for a while,
yeah,
wouldn't
for
it?
For a while. I've got all the time in the world.
Of course, I'll also give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to read while you're there. You can
Thank
take
you.
Another book of your own. What would you like?
I would like Against Nature by J.K. Huisman. The way he talks you through a painting, it's better than going to an art gallery. It's so rich that you can actually only read it three pages at a time.
You can also have a luxury item. What would you like?
A boulder of opium twice the size of my own head.
Well, listeners will make up their own mind about your choice, but I can't refuse you, as illegal substances have been allowed as luxuries previously.
Well, so whose law am I breaking? And I'm not going to be worrying anybody.
There's a precedent there, John, so that is yours.
Thanks.
And finally, which of these eight tracks that you've so carefully chosen would you rush to save if you could only keep one?
No hesitation, Elvis.
John Cooper Clarke, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with us.
Thank you so much, Lauren. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with John Cooper Clarke. Given that he's been compiling his music list for 60 years, I think he did rather well to finally settle on just eight tracks, and all of them such excellent choices. As I hope you know, Desert Island Discs back catalogue boasts an impressive array of poets: Lem Sisse, Wendy Cope, Roger McGough, Rita Dove, Philip Larkin and Les Murray. John mentioned how he was inspired by Pam Ayres, who appeared on the TV talent show Opportunity Knocks in the 1970s. Last year, Pam was cast away by Kirsty Young.
I never set out to be a poet. I didn't really listen to poetry. I wasn't from that sort of a home. Nobody stood around declaiming poetry at each other. And certainly from my point of view, in our home, I'm the youngest child of six children. We were brought up in a council house, and there's nothing wrong with that. But poetry was roundly ridiculed in our house. We didn't have any book-filled libraries or anything like that. Everybody was concerned with making a living. I liked writing. I liked the idea of making people laugh, and I loved performing, and I just knit them all together.
I hinted in the, or more than hinted in the introduction there, that you're unusual as a poet in that you've made your life, you've actually managed to make a living at it. And very few poets do that. You know, often they'll be sort of professors of English, or they'll have a different writing career that runs in conjunction. What would you say has been fundamental to your success?
Well, I'm clearly not in that category, am I? I'm not a scholarly poet at all. I think I've got the common touch. I write about things that I hope people will identify with. Some of my most successful poems, for instance, "They Should Have Asked My Husband," is about the husband who knows it all, and it doesn't matter what you talk about, he's going to come in and monopolise the conversation. And I'm not saying my husband's like that, because he's not. But everybody knows somebody like that. And I search for those subjects. There's always a temptation to think that because something looks simple and it goes ta-tum, 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 that it's easy. But actually it isn't, because you've got to find the right word that says exactly what you want to convey, and you've got to get the stress on the right syllable. And I find it like a fascinating jigsaw to put it together. And the best thing is to get a big laugh at the end. And that's the most difficult thing, because you don't want it to peter out. You want it to have a, you know, finish with a big bang at the end.
The marvellous Pam Ayres. You can listen to the whole of that programme and many more on BBC Sounds and on the Desert Island Discs website. Next week, my guest will be Dame Sally Davis. I do hope you'll join us.
Is the daily grind getting you down? Fancy taking a break and going out into nature this summer? Then look for Go Wild in BBC Sounds, a place for some of the best nature programmes from Radio 4. Get some inspiration for your next adventure, no matter how big or small. Just search for Go Wild in BBC Sounds and set out on your next adventure today.